90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City, Community Radio. Streaming online at www.kkfi.org.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Hello and good morning. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. Today, our guest is Mr. DeAndre Webb with Loan Depot. And folks, interest rates are historically low, and this is a great time to refinance your house, or if you're not a homeowner, look at purchasing a house. And we're going to be discussing how you can refinance your house and save money each month, or in some cases, find a fixer-upper and renovate that. A little bit about our guest. He is a management professional that has worked in finance, consumer, and mortgage lending since 2003-2004. In 2003, he was licensed as a financial advisor with Waddell & Reed and held a Series 7 and appropriate life, accident, and health insurance licenses in the state of Louisiana. In 2004, he began his path in the mortgage industry and transitioned that experience in 2013 over to renovation mortgage financing as his primary niche. In addition, he has about 5 years' experience in small box retail and grocery management, and he possesses a proven track record as a top-level customer service. So our guest today also has a master's in business association from Central Missouri State, now just the CMSU. So good morning, Mr. Webb. Welcome to Cowtown Conversations.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So I've told our listeners a little bit about yourself and a little bit about how long you've been in the mortgage industry, but what made you decide to work in the mortgage industry?
Good question. It was really an opportunity arose through a childhood friend that had been like a best friend since I was about 13 years old, still is a good friend, and his wife was working at the company that I started working at, and I had been talking to them, and she talked to me about a management training program that the company had and suggested I apply. And so I went ahead and applied. I figured, at the time it may be easier to give money away than ask people for their money when I was working as a financial advisor to try to grow my business when I was in New Orleans at the time. So that's kind of how I got introduced to the industry. And that was 2004. I got hired and pretty much been in the business ever since then, other than about a year and a half or so once, during the housing crisis period.
So you are a mortgage loan consultant. What is the role of a mortgage loan consultant when you're trying to buy a house or get qualified for a house?
Yeah, so on the purchase side, our role really is to kind of guide clients, answer questions. So you may work with people who are investors or own multiple properties and are pretty experienced with the process. Or you may work with people who are brand new to the process, consider themselves first-time homebuyers, and are a little bit nervous. So it's a wide range of types of customers and clients that you assist. And really the role is to give them the guidance on, what the process looks like and what to expect as best as your ability, because there's a lot that goes on during managing a transaction. But to try to keep it as simple as possible. So I try to keep it on the level of the client, and not overwhelm them with industry jargon if it can be avoided, or if they're newer to, the industry in terms of first-time homebuyers. Really the process is like the four C's of credit, where you have, capital, which is funds that you have available. You have credit, which is your credit score. You have capacity, which is your income. And then you have the collateral, which is the property. And so for the most part, all lending, whether it's mortgage lending or any type of lending, involving a secured type of loan, which means you're securing it to some type of collateral property, pretty much falls in line with the four C's of credit for the most part. So the stronger you are in those categories, really the three, capacity, your income, which applies to debt-to-income ratio calculations, your credit, which is your credit score, you're at least at the minimum that the programs allow, and then your capacity, which is, you know, your income. So that's kind of what we do. We just kind of help guide customers, pre-underwrite files, put them in the best position to be successful once they're out shopping.
So, DeAndre, mortgage rates are at an all-time low. What is behind this drop in mortgage rates that we haven't seen in more than a generation?
Yeah, it's a little tricky, and it's not an exact science, but I follow some industry professionals that track it on a daily basis just to stay kind of in tune with what's going on, and it doesn't always make sense, but really, it's tied to the overall economy, I guess is the best way I can say, and the market and what's taking place or what people's expectations or what's going to happen are. So during 2020, you saw a huge boom, not only in purchase, but in refinance business, because you really throughout that whole year, once COVID hit and things got situated probably around April, everything just took off from there in the industry. So it was a very busy year. Up to, I'd say, January, early February, we had some of the lowest interest rates that I've seen probably my entire time in the business. And it was a great time to be looking to refinance, you know, I'd say in that last 12-month period. There's a little volatility. Once administration shifted and that change took place and people were speculating about what is going to happen or what's not going to happen and inflation here and all this stuff, along with the stimulus package that was passed, which kind of calmed things down. It did cause some concerns in the market to where rates started to rise during the month of March. I'd say late February throughout March, there was a lot of volatility and rates kind of came up maybe 0.5% or so, which they're still at a historical low, you know, range, but they have come up some. But it's really because the outlook is getting better for the economy off of the stimulus package. So I'm really looking forward to seeing what's going to happen with the infrastructure plan. It doesn't get passed. That will have some effect on rates. But I've noticed probably last couple weeks, week and a half, things have settled down with the volatility of how rates were moving on a daily basis. So to not confuse anyone, basically rates kind of flow with the market and people's expectations of what's going to happen with the market and the economy overall.
So, DeAndre, how does a person start the process to qualify for a mortgage, and what documents are needed to qualify for that mortgage?
Yeah, initially they just want to reach out to a loan officer or a mortgage consultant like myself. You know, they can reach out to one person. They can reach out to a couple. If they want to get some comparisons, it's perfectly fine. You're going to be asked to submit an application. A lot of things have moved to the tech side now in the industry to try to streamline processes and make the experience better for consumers. So you're probably looking at completing an online application. That would be step one. From there, the lender will work up, you know, review the credit, review the income, and try to work up a deal in the range of what you're looking to do, either a purchase price or a comfortable payment range that you let them know you're comfortable being at, and then try to issue a pre-approval. They're going to ask for your pay stubs. They're going to ask for W-2s. They may ask for tax returns, but it's not always required that you have to have tax returns. If you're self-employed, expect to need to provide personal and business returns for a two-year period. They're going to ask about your assets. So a lot of times people will apply for a mortgage and they'll put that they have zero money. When I say assets, that's like liquid funds in a bank account, 401k, a CD, IRA, something that you have access to. Gift funds from a family member, because a lot of programs allow gift funds. And so they're going to ask for assets, income, and some identification like your driver's license, W-2s. Those are the initial basic forms of documentation that will be asked for. And then as you get deeper into a transaction, there may be some other things that pop up that, you know, letters of explanation, stuff like that come into play as well. That's pretty standard in the industry.
DeAndre, I'll go ask this question, I'll go back. There are three credit bureaus, and each one has a different credit score. It's like it's like Home Depot, good, better, best. You go in, this one may be good, this one may be better, and the next one may be best. How do they score that when you're applying for a mortgage?
Yeah, so good question. In the industry, you're typically going to have all three bureaus pull, so that's Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion, going to pull all three scores. And then the industry will eliminate the low score and high score, and they will score your application off the middle score. Typically, right now, the industry low, I haven't heard of anyone at this time since COVID hit going under a 580 credit score. So depending on the lender, 580 and up is probably going to be a range of what you could potentially qualify for something at. Some might be a 620, some might be a 640. And that's just the overlay that those lenders have. It's called an overlay in the industry that they have a higher requirement than what the FHA or the entities that back mortgages require for that loan program. So the middle score, so there's a lot of variance with scores out in the world. Obviously, people are tracking their credit scores, and there's different algorithms that are being used. Like, a lot of people are using Credit Karma. They use Vantage 3.0. So a lender score may not match up to that because most lenders aren't using Vantage 3.0 to verify. We use a FICO 2.0. There's FICO 8.0. So it just really, you really kind of have to dig into what score you're looking at if you're trying to determine if your scores are improving or not and where they are and how that matches up to the type of score that the lender is going to pull. Since Credit Karma hit with their app and the convenience, it really has confused a lot of people, but that's just, you know, something that you have to pay attention to is the type of score that you're looking at as compared to what the lender may be pulling. And that's it. We'll look at past derogatory delinquencies and bankruptcies. May not disqualify you from purchasing a home, or there may be a minimum required waiting period depending on when those discharge that you have to wait. And that's the type of stuff that we'll provide guidance on once we can take a closer look.
Now, I know we've all been told don't let them pull your credit because each credit pull takes you points. But if you're going to shop your mortgage or if you're going to shop around for a mortgage, it's best to do it within a 2-week period so that lenders kind of see that you are looking for a mortgage and the credit hit will not be as severe as it did if you did one month, one another month, and one the month after. Is that right? Is that incorrect or correct?
No, that's pretty accurate. Typically, the three bureaus will allow 30, it's around 30 days. For you to shop, and this is for automobiles or mortgages, without hitting your credit score for each inquiry, because they know people need to shop. Back when I first got into the industry, it was nothing to see, you know, someone had their credit shopped 80 times and have 80 inquiries and all 80 hit their score like 5 or 7 points and just destroyed them from 700. Now they're in the 600s or 500s. So that was a positive change in the industry and with the three main credit bureaus that they implemented. So the other factor is because people are really, they do call and they want you to just give them some numbers over the phone, pull them out of the air because they're afraid to have their credit pulled. But really, I try to advise people, if you don't think your credit is borderline, like on that 580 to, you know, or under or really under that, it's best to still apply and let a lender take a closer look, because then we can give you more definite information and guidance on what you might need to do. There's also something called rescores in the industry, so we may be able to run your credit through our credit simulator tool, depending on the lender you're working with and what options they have available to them, and run scenarios on how to get your score up from a 560 to the 580 or to the 600 or over 620. You know, so there's different options. There's really too much emphasis nowadays to me, just being a professional in this industry for so long, on credit inquiries. Inquiries really only make up 10% of the overall credit score calculation. So, and each inquiry, you know, hits you maybe 5 to 7 points. So where you really got to be more cautious with inquiries is consumer debt, like credit cards and unsecured personal loans and having a lot of those. If you're shopping for a mortgage, there's no reason to be afraid. You know, if you know you want to buy in a certain time frame, 90-day window or 120 days or something like that, there's no reason to not have your credit pulled and be afraid of a credit inquiry, especially if you've applied with other lenders within a short window of time. But even outside of that time, you may be looking at your score being affected 5 or 7 points, which is, like I said, if you're not really borderline, it's not really going to be that significant of an issue.
DeAndre, when it comes to qualifying for a mortgage, there are three words that can seem to strike fear into people. DTI, or debt-to-income ratio. When you're looking at qualifying for a mortgage, what is that loan consultant looking at if you're applying or trying to refinance your house with in regards to your DTI?
Yeah, so debt-to-income ratio is basically the amount of debt you have that reports to your credit. So it's only debt, so it's not like daycare expenses and utility expenses. We're not looking at that type of stuff, or grocery and gas. We're not calculating any of that. We're looking at debts that report to your credit and the monthly payments on those debts. Okay, so we take those monthly payments plus what the proposed mortgage payment might be on what you're trying to qualify for, and then we divide that by your gross monthly income. Now, notice I said gross income, and nobody lives off of gross income, but that's how the industry calculates qualification. It lets you qualify for more than what you might be able to qualify for if we were using net income, which is your take-home after-tax money. But nonetheless, that's the calculation. So the industry standard will say, you know, if you're around 30% on your debt, on your total debt ratio, you know, that's a good standard, or if your mortgage is 30% or less than your total, and that's called a housing ratio calculation. It doesn't come into play that much, but we do look at it. But you, depending on the program, you may be able to qualify, you know, with a 50% debt-to-income ratio, depending on the program that the lender is looking at, because some programs have more flexibility in those cases and allow higher debt-to-income ratios. So, yeah, it's really what I call step two. Step one is credit. Do you meet the minimum, you know, required credit score for the program? And then you can kind of, you're knocking on the door, and then you can come in the door if you got the minimum required credit score. And then the next is, where is your debt to income ratio at, and how's your income look for the amount that you're trying to qualify for? Or now you're inside the door and you're getting ready to sit at the table, and we're going to want to look at your assets or liquid funds available, how you're going to cover down payment, closing costs if the seller won't pay your closing costs. To help you get into a house.
Now we're going to talk about two things, the two P's that really perplex people. And the first one is points. And people looking, they go to apply for that mortgage and they see points. Mm-hmm. DeAndre, what are points?
So points, they're called discount points. And really, they're what gives you flexibility in the type of interest rates you want or you want to look at. So in the industry, we may have what's called, there's a term in the industry called par pricing, let's just say. I mean, that's what it is. And that means that's the interest rate we can offer where there would be basically no points and no credits. It's like the even point, zero cost at this particular interest rate. But say you can pay a half a point or a point to get your interest rate down, you know, maybe 0.25% more or further. That is a fee to pay to buy down the interest rate to get a lower interest rate. And typically that's what points are. When we say 1 point, that's 1% of the loan amount. So it's an added cost to the transaction for you to buy your interest rate down, depending on the cost of the lender's pricing at any given lower interest rate to get that interest rate lower. And so it's not an automatic 1 point is 1% lower. It doesn't work that way. A lot of times people think it does. It just means that to get to any given interest rate, if the cost is 1 point, that's 1% of the loan amount to get to that specific interest rate based on the lender's pricing. So it's a way, you know, to get a little more savings. So if the cost is offset by the monthly savings and you can recoup the cost of that through the monthly savings in a shorter window, It typically, you know, I say it makes more sense to, you know, consider some points. It's not really anything to be afraid of. Sometimes the points are a factor of your credit score. So if you're 620 and higher at a certain interest rate, maybe your points are less or there's no points. But if you get into the below 620 and below 600 credit score, there's a risk offset, and the cost of any interest rate is higher as compared to someone with a higher credit score. So that's kind of how, without getting too confusing, that's kind of where points come into play. They're not, they sometimes have a negative connotation around them, but they're really not a negative thing to me. It's just really what any individual person's preference is. But say a year ago, before COVID hit, you know, you may not be able to see a rate in the threes or twos, you know, by paying points or paying a lot of points. And now you might be able to get to the under three and the twos by paying a half point or a point, depending on your credit score. And so it's something to consider, depending on how long you plan to live in the home. You know, if you plan to live in the home for 5-7 plus years, and you can recoup that cost in that window by the monthly savings between the difference between two rates, it makes sense to consider it.
So
hopefully I explained that without being too confusing.
If a person has a $200,000 house, mm-hmm. and they want to buy it down by 2 points, that would cost them $4,000, correct? Because each point would be $2,000.
Yep, in that scenario, that's correct.
So,
and that just adds to the bottom line. So basically you would pay that at your closing as additional cash to close due. It would just add to the bottom line figure.
So, DeAndre, let's talk about that other P, that one that can hit people really hard, private mortgage insurance, or PMI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so PMI is that's the best. It's basically a risk insurance that covers the guarantors of loans or purchasers. So Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, it's called mortgage insurance premium with FHA, but it's basically the same thing. Private mortgage insurance just means it's issued through private mortgage insurance companies. On conventional Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac transactions. It's really in place as a default risk insurance. It doesn't protect you, the borrower, or the homeowner. It protects the guarantor of the loan, which is the entities, the government-sponsored entities, essentially Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, et cetera. Its role is, historically, was to allow a unique opportunity for lenders or these agencies to offer maximum financing. So that means you don't put 20% down on every transaction to buy a house. So with FHA, you can finance up to 96.5% on a purchase. With a conventional loan, Freddie Mac or Fannie Mae, you can finance now up to 97% or 95% loan to value. So it's an insurance that they put in place to kind of buffer when they, 30 years ago or whatever, you know, they started introducing these higher limit loan transactions. It's an insurance offset for the industry to kind of protect those loans in case of default for that amount that's financed over the 20%. So there are ways to get rid of it through conventional financing. FHA's way to get rid of it is a little more difficult. So you have to do like a 15-year term and be in the house like 10 years before it falls off. But with conventional financing, there's multiple options to get rid of it. You can buy it out up front, so you can pay an extra cost to pay it in a lump sum up front to get rid of it. You can pay it monthly, and then it'll fall off once your loan gets to 78% loan to value or under 80% loan to value. Or you can, there's options where you can finance it in a higher interest rate as well. So lenders on conventional finance would have more flexible options to offer you around PMI and whether or not you want to keep it or not.
So DeAndre, values of homes have skyrocketed. Can a person, they say their houses went up, instead of them having $100,000 worth of equity, now they've got $2.25 on a house that's worth $300,000 just because they're living in the right place. Could that person go get a new appraisal, show the increased value of the house, and submit that to that lender to have that PMI portion removed from the mortgage?
Yes. So typically you would contact the lender's customer service department, and they would have a department that would guide you through that process. But yes, whether the lender is going to place that order for the appraisal or they'll accept a third-party appraisal would depend upon how that department manages that process. I'm not 100% sure on how they do that in those cases, but yes, you can at any time submit an appeal or review to have your transaction reviewed to have the PMI dropped off, yes.
So if you have a question for DeAndre, give us a call on our studio line, 816-931-5534. That's 816-931-5534. So DeAndre, what kind of mortgages does Loan Depot offer? Because being a veteran, I know some places do VA loans, some places don't, some places just conventional, some places offer fixed rates. What type of loans does Loan Depot have for its customers?
I mean, for the most part, we offer everything that's out there in the industry. The main programs are your Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac conventional loans, your VA loans, USDA loan, which is another 100% financing loan for rural properties and people that meet that income requirement, FHA loans, and jumbo loans. Jumbo loans would be a loan that is over the allowed Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac limits, which is around close to $550,000 in most areas. If it's not a high cost area where they might be $700,000 or $8 million, you know, limit. Anything over that, you have to do a jumbo loan, which be like you get into the, you know, $600,000 and up types of transactions. So those are the main programs. There are some other programs potentially that are called non-qualified mortgages. All of those categories meet the definition of what's called a QM mortgage or a qualified mortgage. And then you have what used to be referred to as non-conforming or non-qualified mortgage transactions that some lenders offer through brokers, like where they broker the loan through another lender that offers that program. Like, so they don't have the program in-house, but they have a relationship or a partnership with a company that offers it, and their loan officers can broker those programs. Some of those get into, you know, some sticky areas. You just don't know how that transaction is always going to go. You never worked with that broker lender before and issued a transaction. But those would be like in some of the other areas where you have bank statement loan programs or some of the unique type of transactions, cash flow transactions. Some of those areas would be considered non-conforming or non-qualified mortgage programs.
So we had a caller, DeAndre. They wanted to know if you can give out, you work for Loan Depot, but could you provide your phone number and your website so people can go and take a look and maybe give you a call if they have they wouldn't possibly put in a loan application?
Yeah, my the best contact number for me is 913-215-0090, and that's my work sale. My website through Loan Depot, let me pull the URL, is loandepot.com. Well, it might be easier just to search me, DeAndre Webb, through internet search, and you should see my Loan Depot link. It's DeAndre, it's spelled DeAndrai. And then Web, WEBB. And I'm on, you'll find my Loan Depot website. I have a Facebook business page. I'm on LinkedIn as well. So those would be the main platforms that you could find me on.
Okay. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI. This is Cowtown Conversations. I'm your host, Joseph Jackson. And today our guest is Mr. DeAndre Webb of Loan Depot. Stay tuned right back after this short break. We're back. This is Cowtown Conversations on 90.1 FM. And I'm Joseph Jackson, your host. And we had a caller call back in. And for those that may have a little bit of trouble on spelling Mr. Webb's name, it's DeAndre. AI. Last name is Webb, WEBB. So if you Google him, if you go to one of the search engines and put that in, it'll bring him up with Loan Depot. So DeAndre, you still with us?
I'm still here.
Okay, so for those that may not know, what is the difference in between an FHA and a conventional loan?
Really, the difference is really credit, I would say, and the amount of risk that one program will accept over the other. So FHA, if you have more shakier credit or you don't have as clean of assets or, you know, liquid funds available or quite a bit of funds available, I tend to lean toward going FHA because they're more flexible on past credit issues and lower credit scores. So I would say just the fit of the customer per the program. Conventional loans, they're tougher to qualify for because they accept less risk. So you may have to have quite a bit of a higher credit score. You may have to be, you know, 680 or higher, 700s to get into a conventional loan at a, you know, 3% down or 5% down if you're purchasing type deal. So it really is the cleaner your credit and the cleaner your assets, the more of a fit you are for a conventional loan. If you have, you know, past credit issues, lower credit score, FHA is a more flexible type of program to help you still accomplish your goal, like getting into a home without having to wait a long time to get up to a 700 score or something like that. So that's really the main differences, I would say, and how I view it is a fit based on credit and assets.
So this one is straight off your website, DeAndre. What are five reasons why people should refinance now? You still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I was just looking at that myself. So I'm pulling it back up, but so I can get the answer right. let's see here. But what I would say is it's really based on need, regardless of what this is saying. So if you have an interest rate that is, you know, 4% or up, you should be considering looking at refinancing. If you think you have equity, a lot of equity in your house, and you want to try to tap that equity, you could be considering refinancing. One, to get rid of PMI, or two, because you want to pull some cash out, depending on how much equity you have on cash out refinance. Maybe your credit has improved. So when you originally got into the current loan, your credit wasn't as good and rates were higher. So maybe you have higher credit score and rates are lower now and you can take advantage of that and get some monthly savings. Maybe you do the cash out deal to consolidate debt. You have a bunch of bills you want to pay off and you want to get savings that way and tap into your equity if you have enough. Not very common, but maybe you had an adjustable rate mortgage from the past, and you like to get into a low fixed rate mortgage now. And that those are some reasons that people would consider refinancing.
DeAndre, many people refinancing them right now, but the FHA has a streamlined refinance. What is a streamlined refinance?
Yeah, so the streamlined refinance is a program the FHA has, and VA has a version of it that just allows you to refinance without, say, doing a full, you may be able to do it without a credit pool, without a appraisal, without income verification. So it just basically means it's a streamlined underwriting process. What's allowed can vary based on the lender. So if your current loan is with that lender, you may be able to do the more streamlined version. And if your current loan is coming from a different lender, they may require a credit score or income verification. It just kind of varies from lender to lender. And if you're doing it with the lender that currently holds your loan or you're doing it with a lender that doesn't. So that's something to keep tabs on in the industry as you check. The one thing the streamline doesn't allow is you to finance all the closing costs. So you may have a more streamlined, less document intensive transaction, but you may have to come up with some funds at the closing to cover some of the closing costs because they place a limit on how much over the current loan amounts you can finance. If you do a full refinance, that would just mean you're going to provide all your documentation and we're going to pull credit and we're going to order an appraisal and you will be able to wrap all closing costs into the transaction. So that would be the difference between a non-streamlined and a streamlined FHA.
And that's provided you have enough equity, correct, to be able to tap that equity?
Yeah, on the streamlined version, they really can go off state advice, so it's not that big a deal. But yes, on a full refinance, if you're doing an appraisal, that will come into play. On a refinance, FHA will go up to 97, almost 98% loan to value. So on a refinance, you can get up pretty high. If you're doing a cash out refinance, you're going to be limited to 80% loan to value. So the maximum loan amount would be, 80% of whatever the home appraises at. So on a $100,000, just to do simple math, for a cash out refinance on a $100,000 appraisal value, the maximum loan amount would be $80,000. So you could, if you owed 50 and your house was worth 100, you could get a loan for up to 80. And that's about a $30,000 difference of cash to you. Out of that $30,000, the lender will cover the closing costs, and then you would net the rest, or you could consolidate some bills. So that, just to give you an example of how a cash-out refinance would work.
So, DeAndre, when you refinance, it has to be cost-effective. Does the old adage of 0.75 interest rate decrease still hold true?
It really depends, and that's really where your loan officer, mortgage consultant, his role is to help you kind of understand and make sense of it. Some people, if they can get 0.25% lower, it might make sense to them. It doesn't always make sense when you look at a cost analysis, but it could, depending on, the situation, or maybe you're close to getting rid of PMI or something like that, and you can get 0.25% off and eliminate PMI, and it makes more sense. So I don't go by a strict adage of, you need to be minimum lower than a certain percent. The industry sets what's called net tangible benefit requirements, and typically a minimum of 0.25% reduction in interest rate or a certain amount of monthly savings would qualify, or make sense for doing a transaction. But like I said, you have to make sure it makes sense to you and what your primary goal is and trying to accomplish and how close it gets you to that. And that's really unique to every situation. So there's not one blanket transaction scenario that I would say for every person, because every person's situation is a little bit different. And so you just have to take that into consideration as well.
So DeAndre, is it possible to refinance your home, reduce your monthly payment, and take years off your mortgage at the same time?
Yes. Yeah. So it's possible to, go from a 30-year, or you've been in the house 5 years and at 25, and maybe you got in when rates were around 5% or something, and now you can get closer to 3 and drop down to a 15-year. Maybe you're not saving money, but maybe you're paying the exact same amount and you drop 10 years off your mortgage. So those are the types of things that you can look at and weigh. Some people prefer to still go with a longer term, but I like to give options. I think the most important thing is to consider options and try to look at options that are available. So whether you go with that option or not on the lower term, if you qualify, it's something to consider and look at. And a lender should be able to send you both scenarios so you can compare them. One thing you have to consider on a shorter term is how it affects your debt-to-income ratio, because now you're driving your monthly payment up and your monthly outgo, and it could affect your qualification if it drives your debt-to-income ratio up higher. But if you're keeping your payment the same, or you can drop years off and lower the payment, then you shouldn't have a debt-to-income, ratio issue. But, that's definitely something when refinancing to look at. Some people will say, hey, I can pay the same and drop down to 15 years, or I can save, $100 a month or something. At 30 years, I can have more control over the payment. I'm not obligated to the higher payment on the lower term, but if I want to, I can just pay extra and pay it down faster myself. And so some people consider that because they know life happens and they want to have more personal control over their financial situation should life happen to them again. And they'll go back out to a 30-year or something like that, knowing that, okay, I'm going to pay extra each month as I can, but if something happens, I'm not obligated to make that higher payment.
So we're going to talk about your bread and butter now. Many people may not know you're one of the top people when it comes to doing renovation loans in this region. So if a person mm-hmm. finds a home that they just love, but it needs renovation, or they really want to get into a fixer-upper, what type of products does Loan Depot have for them?
Yeah, so the products in the industry there's two FHA loans called a 203K. And there's two versions depending on the amount of work that needs to be done or the type of work, like if there's structural repairs and non-structural repairs. And then there is a conventional renovation loan that has two versions that are similar to the 203K. The conventional renovation loan is called the Fannie Mae Home Style. That program also has a program that has an option that allow investors that plan to hold and rent a property out that need to renovate to work that transaction as well. And what they allow you to do if you're purchasing is to wrap the purchase budget and a renovation budget into one loan, like one 30-year note combined as one. And during the transaction, it adds a little bit of an extra layer to the transaction because now we're setting up a renovation. We're working with your contractor that you pick out to get the bid and scope of work so that when the loan closes, we've got the loan transaction piece done. We've got a slight validation of your contractor. So we do a validation of the contractor you pick and just verify they have whatever appropriate licenses are required and that they have liability insurance, et cetera, and we get their background information. And then that job is ready to go as soon as the loan closes so that everything is set up and the work can begin promptly. And then you have a certain amount of time, up to 12 months max, to complete the renovations. So streamlined versions of the product typically hit around $30,000 to $50,000, depending on if you're going with the FHA loan or the conventional loan. And that will allow a contractor to receive an initial deposit after closing. The more intensive programs where there's structural repairs or it's a larger scope of work over $30,000, over $50,000, will be paid on a draw schedule to the contractor, so there won't be an initial deposit. And there's a required inspector, typically known as a HUD consultant or a 203K consultant, that helps kind of manage the project and is essentially an independent contractor to the consumer. And they manage all the draw inspections and help with contractor issues and stuff like that. So yes, those are very good programs, not very well known because not a lot of loan officers understand them or even know how to do them. Not a lot of lenders offer the programs or offer all versions of the program. There is also a VA renovation loan that's newer to the market probably in the last 3 years, 3 or 4 years, but it has been suspended when COVID hit. So VA suspended that program when COVID hit, and they have not bought that program back out of suspension yet. So we're waiting to hear if that program is going to become available again soon, hearing some chatter around it. But once it does, then that would be an additional program for a veteran that can also take advantage of the renovation programs.
So you mentioned it, but I want to reiterate this. If you do a 203K renovation loan, can the homeowner do any of the work, or do they have to have licensed professionals to do that work?
Yeah, it's very difficult. So if you look at the program's parameters, they will say from the agencies that self-help is allowed, but they leave it up to the lender to determine what they will or won't allow. And so most lenders either don't allow it, and it's really tied to the fact that the work doesn't get done in a timely manner, or they only allow it in cases where the client or borrower themselves is a licensed contractor by trade. That's what they do for a living. In those cases, you should be able to get approved. It still may be a little difficult, but you should be able to get approved. But no, you can typically do not plan with one of these programs to do the work yourself. You're going to have to find a contractor that we validate. You pick out your own contractor. We don't do it. I don't refer contractors, so that there's no conflict of interest. And then I just provide the guidance on the next steps we need to follow from there. The one thing to keep in mind, too, with these programs is we're doing a different type of appraisal. So we're getting the bid for the scope of work that you plan to do from the contractor because we're going to use that when we order the appraisal. Typically, on a regular transaction, you would do a what's called an as-is appraisal. And that just means the appraiser is going to go out and they're going to appraise the home as it sits, as is. With this type of transaction, we're going to do a subject to appraisal, or often referred to as an after renovated value appraisal. And that just means that they're going to look at the scope of work that we sent them, and they're going to appraise the property as if that renovation is already complete to the best of their ability. And they're going to value it based on that. And that's what we set the loan up on. So it's a case where, you know, whether you're doing it as a purchase or even you can do them as refinances also, is where you're going to actually know the return on your investment during a transaction before you close. You're going to know if you're adding equity to it or if you're potentially over renovating the property, so your equity is not as deep. But that's something I like about those programs.
So, DeAndre, I know a lot of people, they have homes, but they need a lot of work. So that sounds like a great plan if you're in a neighborhood where the market is hot and your house may need $30,000-$40,000 worth of work, but you say a new roof, you know, upgrade the electrical, do some minor things that could then turn around and bring you an additional $60,000. It may be worth it in that case to do, take out the renovation loan, do the repairs, and then put your house on the market.
Yeah, it's definitely something you can consider. The type of program that we go with is really going to be based on your intent, what you intend to do over the next 12-month period. Do you intend to occupy the property or do you intend to sell it? And that will determine which type of program we need to use, if we need to use the investor-type transaction because you're going to get it renovated and put it right on the market, or you plan to live in it for a year, get it renovated, live on it for about a year, and then list it from there. We could do the owner-occupier program. The good thing about the 203K loan is it does allow you to go up to 110% of the after-renovated value. So if you're in a situation, even on a purchase transaction or refinance, that the value may be tight with, you know, the amount of renovations that need to be done and what you already own the property, it does provide more flexibility to help get you in the house still, because you can go up over 100% loan to value if you needed to with that program. And that would only make sense if you plan to stay in the home for a while.
So, DeAndre, when people are out looking at the mortgage, to make sure they're comparing apples to apples and oranges, what things should they be looking at?
Well, one of the things you can look at that the industry has provided is the APR. So APR really only is significant. It's a significant calculation to consider, because it doesn't really – APR is not what your payment's based on. Your interest rate is what your payment is amortized over. APR is a number that the industry comes up with where they take into account some of the closing cost. They take into account the interest rate plus the closing costs and some of the lender fees, and they give you a calculation. It's called APR, annual percentage rate. That is the tool used for when you shop. So if you're applying with three different lenders and one lender has a lower APR and another lender has a higher APR, it only means that the other lender with the higher APR, the cost of their loan is a little more expensive, and that's apples to apples. So that's the same interest rate they're quoting you, the same dollar amount of the loan, and you're comparing apples to apples. Then that would tell you, okay, something this lender's quoting me is more expensive than the other lender. And it may be tied to the points that we discussed earlier. One lender may be able to offer that rate at slightly higher points than the other lender is at a little bit lower points, and so that affects the APR for the other lender, and one's higher. And that's kind of just helps you decide. The other thing you got to consider is, you know, the lender's response time, how they communicate, and just how the lenders you speak with, how they make you feel in general, because you're going to be going through a stressful process on a purchase. It can be overwhelming, especially in this market where it's very competitive. For buyers to make offers and win a bid. So you want someone who can make you feel comfortable, who knows what they're doing, and who can help provide guidance, or if you need to update a pre-approval in a short amount of time, you know that they're able to accommodate you as best they can.
So, DeAndre, what is something that you should not do once your house is in escrow and you're going to close in maybe, say, 30 days, like change a job, go out and buy new furniture? Are those things you should do or things you shouldn't do?
I would just say, before you do anything, speak to your lender. Speak to your loan officer or mortgage consultant. Don't move any money. Don't move money around because you're under contract now and you start moving money around before your lender has a chance to know what's going on, because it could affect your qualifications. That ties into anti-money laundering laws and how money is moved, and we have to be able to source and document where money comes from. Is it cash or not? So the lender can provide better guidance on what you're thinking you want to do before you do it, if you can contact them first. Don't make any huge purchases or new credit inquiries without speaking to your lender during a transaction, because that could cause an issue as well. Don't open a new account. Say you bought a new car, then go buy the house. You know, if you can avoid it, you know, don't do that. Get the house purchase first and then, you know, complete a new transaction on the automobile if you can. Those would be some of the main things I would say. if you change jobs in the middle of a transaction, it won't disqualify you, but it may require the timeline of closing to be extended. But job changes, as long as you're full time and your pay is the same or greater, you know, are not as big a deal. Just make sure your lender knows so that they can update that. They would have to update the application with the new job information, and they could provide guidance on what would be needed before closing. Typically, it's like one pay stub.
So we got three quick questions here. DeAndre, sure. Many millennials are staying home longer due to student loan debt and reduced job opportunities. How is this affecting the housing market?
Well, millennials are, industry-wise, millennials are anticipated to be one of the biggest opportunities, you know, right now and into the near future for lenders. So a lot of things are being geared toward millennials, especially when you see a lot of technology updates that have taken place in the industry. I do know that, yes, due to some of the housing crisis stuff, that demographic has had it tough, and some of them are staying home longer, but they're still buying, too. And so something to consider is if you have a good job and you're staying at home with parents, but you're able to save some money, that's your down payment, that's your closing costs, keep saving that money. Parents can also gift you money if they want to help you get out the house, and they have $2,000 or whatever. They can gift money, and people are doing that, providing the gift to help their kids purchase a home. In rare instances, a parent could act as a cosigner. So if you don't qualify for what you need to, and you need a what's called a non-occupying cosigner, the programs do allow that, and a parent could say, "Hey, I'll help cosign to get you in the house," and then after a year or two, you're on your own and refinance, and let's take me back off. So those are some of the things that I would say could be considered for millennials. But there's opportunity out here. The one thing you got to keep in mind in this market is you're going to pay a high price for whatever property you get. Because if it's a nice property in a desirable area, they're getting 5 to 10 offers, you know, or more in the first day on the market. And you got to be very aggressive. So just plan to be aggressive and that you're going to have to pay a steep price.
So we're closing out here. Can you give your phone number again and how to spell your name so people can find you if they want to contact you?
Sure. My phone number, 913-215-0090. Correct spelling of my name is DeAndre, DiAndraI, Webb, WEBB. I'm on Facebook. I'm on LinkedIn. And you can Google from our website. And my email is dweb@loandepot.com.
I want to thank DeAndre for being our guest today. We're never in Cowtown Conversations without our Community Minute. If you still need to get your income taxes prepared and earn less than $57,000 per year, please contact United Way at 201 for help in Missouri and Kansas. Councilman Brandon Ellington of Mount Sinai will host a community food distribution today, Thursday, April 8th, at Mount Sinai Church, located at 3634 Brooklyn. The giveaway will be from 11 to 1. The 3rd District will have a virtual Zoom meeting held this Monday, April 12th. To receive a link, please contact Deidre Johnson at 816-513-6511. For Cowtown Conversations, I've been your host, Joseph Jackson. Join us next week as we continue our Money Smart Conversations. And we have Carla Walker of United Country Realty. And we'll talk about buying or selling a home or getting your home ready to sell in this hot market. I hope you have a great day. Stay safe, wear a mask, and stay tuned for My Place with Larry J.